It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Pope is here, Scott Walker is out, and the federal government could be looking at another shutdown. We'll take a look at this week's national political news.
First, a national report from earlier this year shows Wisconsin is the third worst state in the nation for the condition of our roads. The report said 71% of Wisconsin roads are in mediocre to poor condition.
Transportation funding was a huge issue in the last budget cycle, but the state legislature didn't provide the money local governments were asking for. So now the Transportation Development Association is working with the state's municipal governments in a new outreach campaign. It's called Just Fix It, to highlight the worst roads in the state.
Craig Thompson is with us to talk about it. He's the executive director of the Transportation Development Association. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about what Just Fix It is. How does it work?
Well, it's really just a joint effort with the Counties Association and the League of Municipalities and Towns Association to really just talk with communities across the state about what they're experiencing with their transportation networks, and to sort of go into each community and hold up a mirror and say, you know, do you like what you see?
Well, it's interesting because what it seems like you're trying to do is to put a face, if you will, on these roads, to actually have these roads tell a story about where the state is with its transportation. Is that part of it?
I think it is, and it's not just the roads. It's our bus systems as well, and to some extent our ports and aviation systems. But a lot of it is our roads and our bus systems. And there's been a lot of studies, I said, in one of the most recent ones, but there's been others. And I think there's the data is there, but perhaps sometimes we do need to go out and see the pictures and hear the stories for it really to hit home.
Why do you feel that we need this campaign right now in Wisconsin?
Well, I think your lead-in told a lot, that according to the DOT's latest report, the conditions of our roads here are worse than every other state other than Illinois and Connecticut. And, you know, that's not just inconvenient as far as bumpy rides or causing damage to our cars. It also means that a lot of times counties and towns are posting their bridge for weight limits because, you know, they just can't withstand it. And that causes agriculture people to increase their costs for having to go around timber haulers, all kinds of impacts on the economy, which you know, far outweigh if we just paid to fix it.
Well, give us a snapshot, if you will. Where are we with the state of roads in Wisconsin and the other stuff you're mentioning, the buses, the infrastructure?
Well, the Transportation Finance and Policy Commission that I sat on looked at the next 10 years and really came up with what would it take just to sort of maintain the level of service we have now, which isn't necessarily great. And the gap for that was about $15 billion over the course of those 10 years, or about $1.5 billion a year. So we have significant needs at really every level, cities, towns, villages, counties, and the state roads.
Now, there was that referendum in 2014 saying that money used for the transportation budget could not be used for anything else. It couldn't be rated as one term for it. Why isn't that enough?
Well, that's a great question. You know, for a while we heard from some lawmakers that they understood that we need to, that these transportation systems are important and that we need to perhaps adjust user fees to fix them. But they said we're unwilling to do that until we know for sure and we can promise the voters that all the money is going to go where it's supposed to. So we entered into an effort along with other groups to have a constitutional amendment to ensure that, and it passed by an overwhelming vote. 80% of the public in the last gubernatorial election came out and supported that and amended our constitution so that now when we pay gas tax and registration fee, it has to go back towards that upkeep. But for some reason, that wasn't enough to have them act in this budget.
We're talking right now with Craig Thompson, Executive Director of the Transportation Development Association. He's joining us to talk about the new outreach program called Just Fix It. And Craig, I wonder if you could tell us about some of the particular roads, the particular needs that you say that you see out in the state right now. If we were to hit the road, where would you point us to say, look, there really is a need and it's an urgent one?
Well, I think I would point you to almost anywhere you live in this state to just go out and drive around. I don't think you'd have to drive outside of your city or county to find a lot of these roads that really are getting into significantly bad shape. And a lot of them, you don't even feel it at first while the substructure deteriorates before it gets to that. But as you said, over 70% of our roads are in tough condition, so I don't think you have to travel too far.
Now, when we look at the causes behind the need that you're describing, where would you say it started? Where did the state of Wisconsin start to lose its ability to keep things up?
Well, if you look at the numbers, it really goes back about a decade, I think, or so. We didn't rely nearly as much on bonding in the early 2000s as we do now, and our user fees were more commensurate with what we needed. But we got rid of gas tax indexing, and we haven't adjusted any user fees since then. And so it's really been a steady, really kind of going over and over again of not adjusting the user fees and just relying more on borrowing. Or cutting each budget.
Now, who is on the hook when it comes to fixing roads? How much do local communities, for instance, have to pay?
Well, you know, for the locals, they end up probably bearing about 60% to 70% of the costs, sometimes 80, through the property tax, and they'll get reimbursed by the state for anywhere from 40%, 30%, or 20%.
And in terms of how much it actually costs to fix these roads up, say a mile of road that needs resurfacing, what would that cost?
Well, that kind of varies, I think, depending on what level of road you're talking about. Greatly, I don't really have a specific number for you.
How would you make the case that this is an important issue, that transportation funding should be at the top of the state's to-do list?
Well, I think if you look at Wisconsin's economy, we are agriculture, we are manufacturing, and we are tourism. And those are the three most transportation-dependent industries you can find. So when we start impacting those industries, we're having a huge impact on our economy as a whole.
Now, the latest budget did not give the full requested amount to the transportation fund. In terms of the gap there between what was given and what was asked for, what's the consequence of that as you see it?
Well, again, at the local level, it just continues to make their schedule of how many miles of road they can repave or replace just goes out further and further. I know the Towns Association was just surveying their members, and they've got a lot of replacement schedules that are at 200 to 300 years for roads that are built to last 20 or 30. At the state level, there's specific projects that have been delayed. Around here, it's in Madison, it's for the Verona Road project. Looks like it's going to be pushed back. I-3990 is delayed several years. Highway 441 up in Appleton is probably going to be pushed back, as is Highway 23. And so, those big projects get pushed back, and then everything behind it just sort of has a cascading effect.
Craig, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Craig Thompson, Executive Director of the Transportation Development Association. He was with us to talk about the new outreach programs called Just Fix It. Pope Francis is set to address Congress tomorrow, and the presidential field is a bit smaller after the departure of Wisconsin's Scott Walker.
Joining us now for a look at those and other top stories is Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538. Harry, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, on Monday, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker pulled out of the Republican primary field, encouraged some of his colleagues to follow his lead. You've been writing about this, Harry, and you wrote that the candidates who drop out early doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad candidates. How so?
So, I'll start off by just saying that Walker dropping out was a huge surprise, given that we all thought he was going to be a pretty strong candidate. And the fact that he dropped out early doesn't dissuade me, or pretty much most people who know what they're talking about, or at least I like to think know what they're talking about, from that opinion. And what basically I looked at was who are the candidates who stayed in the longest, who didn't actually end up winning the nomination. If you look back over time, those candidates are people like Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, basically candidates that most people would agree really had no shot at winning the nomination. And the reason they stuck in the race was simply because they had nowhere else to go. They had nothing better to do. They weren't looking towards the future. They recognized that they really didn't have a real shot of winning campaigns in the future. When you look at somebody like Scott Walker, however, you can look back at his own history. Look back to 2006 when he wanted to run for governor, in fact, started a campaign before backing out because he realized he had no real shot of winning the Republican nomination, said, you know what, I'm going to step back, I'll gather my forces, make a stronger run 4 years later. And my guess is we haven't heard the last from Scott Walker, at least on the presidential level.
Right. Some people you wrote get out early because they have something to lose by staying in.
Right, exactly. If you look back, who were people who, got out earlier, these types of people tend to be candidates who have something to lose, who probably want to run in the future, But they don't want to upset the party apparatus. Remember, in this year, in 2015-16, for the 2016 race, you have somebody in Donald Trump who's running, who's sucking up all the oxygen in the room. And the last thing that the establishment wants is to be divided. They want a strong candidate to be able to take on the likes of somebody like Trump. And when Walker's in the race and you have Rubio and Bush and Kasich, that divides the establishment vote. And what the establishment wants is to get behind one strong candidate. And Walker, I think, recognized that fact. Now, Walker had other problems for sure. But Walker recognized that fact and recognized that if he stayed in the race too long, he would upset the establishment. And if Walker wants to run for president in the future, he's going to need the establishment backing. So he figured, why? I'm going to cut my losses. Why upset people when I really have no shot of winning this year?
Speaking of Donald Trump, in his brief exit speech, Scott Walker didn't say Donald Trump by name, but he who shall not be named, I guess, the front runner, he said. He was encouraging other candidates to get out of the field to do, as you say, counter Donald Trump. Who is next then? Are there other candidates in Scott Walker's position who might get out and give a similar message?
You know, I don't know if there's anybody as strong as Walker possibly could have been who could get out. But I mean, there's some, you know, there are people like George Pataki, Jim Gilmore, people who really have no shot, who probably, if I were guessing, would be the ones that would get out next. But, you know, you don't know. Remember, Jeb Bush, his super PAC, is going to go on the air, is going on the air right now in Iowa and New Hampshire, and he has favorable ratings, which aren't terrible but aren't really too high, but he's raised a lot of this money that he hopes to be able to spend or have his super PAC spend. And if the numbers don't move for him and he recognizes, you know what, I'm really spending this money and it's not leading me anywhere, then he might be the type of candidate who might take a step back and you say, you know what, I can't stand Donald Trump. I can't possibly have him win. Why am I wasting this money? I can give this money to another candidate who might have a better shot of winning, say, like a Marco Rubio, who I think is one of the candidates who benefits most from Walker jumping out. And that's the type of thing we're going to be seeing in the next few months, weeks and months ahead, is candidates spending money. And if they see the numbers aren't moving, but they have the money, they might decide to give that money to somebody else. Walker, of course, ran out of money, which is part of the reason that he left the race.
One indicator you've been tracking at 538 is endorsements, looking at them in past campaigns and now in this one. These outsider candidates, Donald Trump, Ben Carson, a lot of popularity in some polls, but not getting those endorsements. Now, Carly Fiorina, the other kind of outsider candidate, did get her first endorsement from a sitting congresswoman, Lynn Jenkins of Kansas. Is that a sign? Is that a bit of momentum for her?
Yeah, I mean, Carly Fiorina is this interesting candidate. You know, we have this thing on 538 that sort of tracks, you know, where we think candidates fit in within the Republican Party. And Fiorina, unlike, say, Carson and Trump, kind of has a foot in what we would call the establishment camp. And I think that shows I think she got a second endorsement today from Representative Miller up in Michigan. It kind of shows that she might be able to toe this line between the establishment and the outsider types. And more than that, you know, she's had these very strong debate performances. The Democratic nominee is likely to be Hillary Clinton. So, you know, I think Republicans are thinking, hey, it might not be a bad idea to put a woman up against her. So Fiorina is a candidate who has a lot of promise and a lot of appeal. Of course, the problem with Fiorina is that her record at Hewlett-Packard is going to be, you know, dug into, and they're going to see that there are plenty of flaws with that. Every candidate looks good when you get a first look at them, but then you start to discover what their flaws are, and it's going to be interesting to see if Fiorina can keep her momentum going once people start to dig into her record.
It's our weekly look at national politics with Harry Enten from 538. Let's turn from the presidential race now, Harry, to the Pope. He's not up for re-election anytime soon, I don't think, but he is giving some big speeches at United Nations, Congress. He's talking today, a little parade by the White House. How is he being received? It's putting some people in Congress in a weird position on both sides.
You know, the Pope is so interesting insofar as that, you know, we don't really see anyone like him who has this type, or at least elected officials who has the type of ideology that he does. Somebody who is an economic populist who also believes that climate change, man-made climate change, is a real thing, but at the same time, you know, is pro-life. And holds some pretty conservative views on gay marriage. So it's a very interesting, you know, sort of situation where elected officials will certainly disagree with him on a number of things and agree with him on other things. But if you look at the polling, what you see is that Democrats overwhelmingly hold a far more favorable view of this pope than do Republicans. And that's, I think, because the pope has sort of spoken out more on economic injustice, has spoken out more on climate change, has spoken out more on immigration, has sort of, I think, at least in the American press, his views on social issues are less played up. So there's at least already one Republican who's going to be boycotting his congressional speech tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised if there are more than that. But there's a reason why the president's parading him around, and that's because this pope is seen largely by Democrats as a positive influence versus Republicans who are much more split on him.
Right. Those issues you just listed out, pro-life, but also pro-environment, economic issues, past popes have had pretty similar views, but the emphasis is so different that what used to be a tough issue for Democrats is now a tougher one to juggle, it seems like, for Republicans.
It's exactly right. You know, if I could, you know, make an allusion of the presidential race, it's something almost like a John Kasich, who also, you know, has some liberal positions and some more conservative positions, but his emphasis has potentially been more on those issues that might, you know, sort of be less liked by the Republican base. And that's the same thing almost with this pope, whereby he has plenty of conservative issues, just like all the popes that have come before him. But at least with him, the issues that are being played up are those issues that play more to the Democratic than Republican base. And that's why you're seeing Republicans not as enthused about this pope, while Democrats like President Obama are welcoming him with open arms.
Turning more closely to Congress, abortion and Planned Parenthood are issues on the agenda, Planned Parenthood in particular, with this possible government shutdown coming up at the end of the month. Talk us through the latest on that.
Well, you know, there are a number of things, but obviously if anyone who's been following Congress, you know, over the past few years knows that talk of a shutdown come the end of September is not exactly it's not something that's too surprising.
Harry, it's deja vu all over again, if I can quote the late Yogi Berra.
I'd love any quote from the late Yogi Berra. It's exactly that. You know, it's deja vu all over again. This year seems to be less likely than other years that we're going to have a shutdown. There seems to be movement towards a continuing resolution to fund the government through the end of the year anyway. But, you know, we have to keep our eye out. And the thing that, of course, may very well be the sort of defining point is whether or not the federal government's going to fund Planned Parenthood. And we know that Republicans don't want it to be funded, but, of course, there are Democrats in Congress and a president who needs to sign the legislation. So, you know, that's going to be the dividing point. It's going to be very interesting to see whether or not they could actually fund the government. My guess is that they will, but, you know, with the Republican Congress and the conservative caucus, we can't say for sure.
Ted Cruz, again, wanted to make an issue of this. He was a key player in the last actual shutdown. Is he making a lot of noise?
It's interesting. I think that's one of the more interesting points that's going on in this presidential contest so far is that Ted Cruz really hasn't made so much noise. He's been drowned out. I think a lot of Republicans have been drowned out by Donald Trump. You know, it's going to be very interesting to see as we get right down to the nitty-gritty of the wire to see where these candidates are exactly lining up. But I would say what's at least interesting in Congress is that someone like Kelly Ayotte, a senator up in New Hampshire, she's been making some of the most noise, and in fact, that she's been arguing against the government shutdown, saying that we need to fund the government, there's no place else where we can go, and that if we don't fund the government, it'll be a victory for Democrats.
There's been some talk among conservative Republicans that maybe this is the time John Boehner gets ousted if he doesn't do what they want on Planned Parenthood funding. There's been this kind of talk before. John Boehner is still the speaker. Is there anything to it this time?
I think there's probably more to it this time, but, you know, there was very little to it last time, so just because there's more to it this time, it doesn't really mean anything. It's going to, again, this is one of the things whereby politics is interesting because some things are unpredictable. We can't take a poll of 15 or 20 or 30 Republican congressmen who could overthrow Boehner. I think there's more to it, but at this point, I think there's less to it than there was just a few weeks ago. There was a lot of noise a few weeks ago that they might overthrow him. But right now, it seems...
Sounds like we lost Harry Enten and probably won't get him back in time for news. In the meantime, head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what you think of some of the issues out there in national politics. There are ongoing discussions, of course, of Scott Walker's departure from the presidential race and our upcoming topic looking at farmers markets in Wisconsin and beyond, their growing popularity and why people go there. Head over there, share your thoughts with us on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. In the 1970s, farmers markets were considered an anachronism, something from the past that was dying. In 1971, there were only 340 farmers markets nationwide.
By 2004, that number had increased by more than tenfold. In 2014, there were more than 8,000 farmers markets nationally. Wisconsin is sixth in the country when you take into account the number of farmers markets, CSAs, farm-to-school programs, and food hubs per capita.
Our next guests have researched farmers markets and are with us to talk about what's behind the huge increase in farmers markets nationwide and why Wisconsin is leading that trend. Some research shows that the reasons people shop at farmers markets aren't just economic. People shop at their local farmers markets because it supports their values about community, sustainability, and personal relationships.
We want to know, why do you shop at farmers markets? Do you think they support your personal values? Why do you think there's been such an increase in the number of those markets? And why does Wisconsin come into the top 10 when it comes to local food consumption? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Sarah Rines joins us first. She's a Wisconsin native and a professor of management and organizations at the University of Iowa. She's behind research on why local food markets have increased so much in the United States in recent years. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, why did you decide to study this big increase we're seeing in local food markets nationwide?
Okay. Well, first I'd like to mention that I'm not the only author of this study. I studied this with Ion Bodi Vasi from Romania, who's a professor in both the sociology department here and the Tippey College of Business, and two graduate students, Christina Lee and Jordan Nielsen. But it was Bodhi and I that first started talking about what we could study together. We're both trained interdisciplinarily, and we wanted to work together. And so part of it came out of our personal interests. We both have been very concerned about the environment. We have interests in the environmental movement. Bodhi studied wind production, solar production, fracking. And we also discovered that we both really loved the local farmers market here in Iowa City. And as you may know, Des Moines has a wonderful farmers market ranked in the top 10 in the country. And we also discovered that we both grew up in fairly rural areas around family farms. So both of my grandparents, sets of grandparents, were dairy farmers, one in Door County and one in Kewaunee County. But we have academic interests as well as personal interests, too. And the first one really is what you mentioned at the very beginning of this introduction, and that is we read this paper by Jane Pyle from Mankato State in 1971 saying that farmers markets were an anachronism. She said, any forward-looking person of the 1890s could have foreseen that the farmers market was doomed by a changing society. The railroads connected eastern population centers with distant open lands where favorable climate, cheap labor joined forces to stock the urban larder. And children, never knowing the taste of fresh peas, would not be tempted by a place that sold them.
So interesting to hear. You know, it sounds kind of laughable now, considering the farmers market boom. So what happened to turn the page on that?
Well, yeah, there are two other little puzzles that really sort of interested us. The second one was also mentioned early. The geographical distribution of farmers markets is very uneven. And one of the puzzles is that the states that are doing best per capita in terms of farmers markets and other measures of local food are mostly in the Northeast. Four of the top five are there. Or they're in the Midwest. You mentioned Wisconsin being sixth. Iowa has always been in the top 15. It's been dropping a little bit. And that's kind of curious. So the South, the Southeast, and even California are rated very low. And why is that? Because they have longer growing seasons than we do. They can have open-air markets more of the year than we can. So that's a puzzle to solve. And then the third puzzle was when you read any of the books about local farmers, organic farmers, foodies, Michael Pollan, The Almoner's Dilemma, Joel Salatin, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, Forrest Pritchard, they describe their customers as being highly variable. It's a big tent movement. It's Republicans, it's Democrats, it's the elderly, it's babies coming with their parents, it's people on women's, infants, and children's coupons, it's wealthy foodies. And we're in a very divisive political society right now. So what is it about food that draws in almost everyone?
All right, that's so interesting. So not a niche movement. This is something that sounds like crisscrosses all different strata in the United States. So what did you find that's drawing all these people to that tent?
Well, we had some hypotheses about it. Our first big hypothesis was that even though a farmer's market is a market, we didn't think that we could explain the growth in this completely by the standard variables that you talk about in economics. So, for example, you typically mention price and quantity. Now, there may be some aspects of farmers markets that traditional economics explain. For example, if fresh food tastes better, and most people think it does, the demand for it will rise and the price will rise. So there'll be more people and they'll be paying more. But we thought it went far beyond this, and we had two additional explanations that we proposed. One was that it might be what we call relational exchange. You're not just exchanging a product for money, but you're exchanging relationships, that people have a desire for face-to-face relationships, feeling of a sense of community, that farmers markets might be a remedy for social isolation, the highly individualistic nature of U.S. society. And so, you know, Robert Putnam, a political scientist, wrote Bowling Alone, and the sense of isolation that people have when the community's gone. Research on happiness from Positive Psychology shows that people who have a lot of social relationships are the happiest people. And recently, research on city landscaping and public spaces has shown the importance of green space or the public square to happiness in cities. So you have places like New York City's High Line, or you have in Chicago, you have Millennium Park, or in Madison, you have the wonderful Capitol Square. The second idea that we had was that farmers markets were growing for ideological or values-related issues. And there's a whole field developing in political science and sociology that argues that as people have more disposable income, they don't simply shop based on where they can find the cheapest thing. They actually will spend some of their income supporting businesses where they agree with the values or the morals. And we thought in particular that there were two values or moral issues that might involve interest in farmers markets. The first would be public health and the problems that people know about with confined animal feeding operations. There are nearly 10,000 of those in the country now, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. One of the big problems is the need for massive antibiotics to stave off disease when animals are confined by the tens or hundreds of thousands in a place and standing in their own manure. And that's created a problem for public health in that we now have superbugs that are increasingly resistant to antibiotic treatment in humans. There's the issue of air and water pollution from manure. CAFOs produce 65% of the animal manure in the U.S., and they produce 300 million tons per year, which is more than twice the amount of human waste.
And, sir, I want to get back a little to two of the points you made about the relational aspect, the farmers markets as a community of sorts, and the values aspect, that people go there to express their values. I've heard farmers markets compared to a new kind of religion. And just briefly, before we let you go, what do you say to that? Can you compare it to a religion in a sense, in a broad sense?
Well, I don't know if that's a little bit strong, but certainly Bodie and I think of it as a social movement, as a political social movement, and Michael Pollan has said the same thing. I will tell you that I talked to a local vendor at the farmers market last week who said that to him, farmers are like religious figures. They are working terribly hard for the public interest to do something for the public. They work very long hours, and sometimes they go broke. And he said he actually does think of them as religious figures.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Now, Sarah Rhines, professor of management and organizations at the University of Iowa. She was with us to talk about her new study called Resurgence of the Locavore.
You can call in about the resurgence of the locavore. Why do you think local farmers markets have become popular over the last several years? Why do you shop at them? What do you get out of it apart from the food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Alfonso Morales joins us now. He's an associate professor of urban and regional planning and civil society and community studies at UW-Madison. Alfonso, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
So let's just start with Sarah's last comment there. Religion and farmers markets, seeing farmers as these modern-day religious figures. What do you think about that?
I guess my family's part of the minor hierarchy then of the faith. So my family, I grew up on a farm in New Mexico, and my family's been farming and ranching in West Texas since about 1867. And I believe strongly that farming is an important role in the country, but farming as it might be thought of stereotypically is probably not the only kind of farming that there is. And so one of the things that we need to think about is how the number of markets that have come and gone in society sort of reflect the kinds of farming that has come and gone in society.
And when you hear this research that's emerging about farmers markets being a vortex for community and a place for people not to just buy food but to express their values, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I have a USDA-sponsored research project right now called Indicators for Impact that capacitates market managers. I've had the great fortune to be on Central Time to speak about that project. And for the last few years, we've been helping market managers track the involvement of the community at their market in social, ecological, economic, and health variables. And among the social variables, some of the things that we track are how many people come to the market, what kinds of events are held at the market, what kinds of opportunities then are there for people to visit with each other, to foster friendships, discover new relationships, get on with old friends. So clearly, marketplaces are an important venue for social relationships.
We're talking right now with Alfonso Morales. He's an associate professor of urban and regional planning and civil society and community studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about why Wisconsin is at the forefront of a national locavore trend.
You can call in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan, a regular customer at your local farmer's market? Why do you go? Is it the food? Is it meeting people you know, your farmer's market friends? Is it a sense of community? Is it the values you associate with the food you buy there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with Alfonso Morales of UW-Madison about the popularity of local foods in Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us why you do or don't go to farmers markets. What do you get? Do you like the produce? Is it a community experience for you? Do you sell at farmers markets? Why do you do that? How does it work out for you? Do you feel connected to the community you sell to? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Alfonso, in terms of where Wisconsin is in this whole movement, this farmers market-based local foods, locavore movement, why is Wisconsin at the forefront?
That's a great question, Veronica. I think that one of the central reasons is because we have a great tradition in the state of small family-owned farms. And as noted, as our previous guest noted, economic times became more difficult for those farmers. And research in the 70s, in the 60s, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s documented the change in the economy and the change in food retail activity. And away from farmers markets and small scale and to larger commercial grocery stores like what we see today. But in Wisconsin, the number of small farmers remained fairly steady, has decreased, clearly, but has continued. And small farmers, they're risk averse. What they're always trying to do is create enough income from a variety of sources to stay in business. So they maintained the farmers market tradition. And another important thing, a second matter, was at the same time that Berkeley created a very important farmers market about 1971 to cater to largely middle class, affluent population, the Dane County Farmers Market was created in 1974 with largely the same impulse to serve folks who recognized the quality of good food and missed it, knew that their parents were associated with it, saw what was available in grocery stores, and said, we can recover some of that flavor, some of the wonderful parts of having a farmers market socially, as well as for their own, for the taste of their food.
We're going to go to our callers now, let them in on the conversation. Linda is first in Lake Zurich, Illinois. Linda, hi.
Hi. I can't believe I'm on the radio.
Glad to have you. What do you think about why you like farmers markets?
Well, I love farmers market because the produce is so fresh. A lot of what you get is picked the same day within a couple hours of buying it. And I miss that in the winter months in Illinois because you usually cannot get any fresh produce at the grocery stores. So these couple months that you have in the summer, I really love to take advantage of the farmers market.
And what about this this discussion we've been having about the values? Do you feel like there's either a sense that you're sort of shopping with your values when you're there or that it is a community for you?
Yeah, I think it's values. I like that the food you're buying is made, you know, or produced with some, you know, values that don't include, you know, large-scale, you know, animals, you know, being housed in cages. I like that what you're buying is something that was done in maybe a smaller capacity.
Linda, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that. And Alfonso, when we talk values, what values are associated with farmers markets? What do people think that the values are when they go there?
That's a good question, Veronica. I think that the Farmers Market Coalition, who's our national partner in terms of this research, one of the things that we're trying to do is document the variety of values that people have in shopping at farmers markets. I think people think that of the farmers market as a place where they will foster their own social interests and social opportunities. So they have a sort of an individual interest in it and the value of individual relationships. But I also think that they value ecological concerns. I think that they value keeping money in the local economy. And so there's a number of different values that intersect in farmers markets. I think people value public health. I think that they value the opportunity that the local city or county or organization that fosters the market advances the community interest through developing in that market.
We're talking about the farmers market boom, sort of headquartered here in Wisconsin right now with Alfonso Morales from UW-Madison, talking about why farmers markets seem to reflect people's values. Many people saying that when they shop there, it does reflect their values. Is that true of you? You can let us know, 800-642-1234. Another quick call here from Kelly in Green Bay. Kelly, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
You know, I really enjoy farmers markets because I think it gives you an opportunity to get to know the people that sell there. You get to know the farmers and you get a review, you know, really kind of get a sense of how they feel about what they do. And I think that's important because it's important to know where your food came from, to be able to trust how it was grown, how it was raised, and to know that the animals were raised and harvested in a humane way, know what they were fed, because what the food you eat the same thing that the animals ate. So if you have, you know, if you want to eat organic, if those are things that are important to you, sustainable farming is important to you, I think it's really important to support that. And you really do find that in the farmers market.
Kelly, thank you so much for that. And Kelly began that with saying, hey, you really get to know the farmers when you're there. She's referencing again that community. Let's talk about that community aspect. Does this become, in a sense, a community as though you might find in other groups of people, maybe a church, maybe a club? Is it a community of people who have things in common?
I think that they have the central thing in common of wanting to shop at the market. However, from there, I think that there's a variety of reasons that people have. They actually value very different things. No two people, well, people will have broadly similar values, I think. However, the mix in any given person may change a great deal. So I think that one of the interesting things about our work here in the state is working with small markets in different cities around the state, understanding the role that the markets have, not just for their economic, but also their social impact in those small towns.
And Alfonso, just briefly as we wrap up, where do you see this thing going? Wisconsin at the forefront with farmers markets right now. Do you see this movement just growing and getting bigger?
Well, we certainly aren't saturated. A dissertation student that I sponsored found that the USDA count of farmers markets in Wisconsin was off by about 15%. So we can be pretty sure that even official counts of farmers markets undercount the number that exists and the interest that people have in them.
Alfonso, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Alfonso Morales, Associate Professor of Urban and Regional Planning and Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison. He was joining us to talk about why Wisconsin is leading the nation when it comes to local food trends. We also spoke with Sarah Rines of the University of Iowa about her research on why local food markets have become so popular in recent years.
News today that baseball legend Yogi Berra passed away at age 90. He was a legend for his career as a catcher and later manager, and for his famous, sometimes puzzling, way with words.
As a player mostly for the New York Yankees, Berra was an all-star in 18 of his 19 seasons. He was part of 10 World Series winning teams. And as a manager, he won the World Series with teams from both the American and the National Leagues.
Beyond baseball, he entered popular culture with his unique Yogi-isms. People started calling him phrases like, "It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future." Or, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." You can observe a lot just by watching. "It's deja vu all over again." And, "A nickel ain't worth a dime anymore."
Now, it's not clear whether he actually said all of the quotes attributed to him. As Berra himself put it, "I never said most of the things I said." He thought there might be an impersonator in a 1985 interview with the AP.
"Some of them are true, you know. But I guess some of the people, when they go out of banquet, use my name."
Yogi Berra impersonators at banquets. In 2001, baseball fan and U.S. President George W. Bush honored Berra and offered empathy for the whole language thing.
"Not only because of his baseball skills, but of course for the enduring mark he left on the English language." "Some of the press corps here even think he might be my speechwriter."
Fans and players remembering Yogi Berra today with a minute of silence before games, tributes in the media, and by sharing their favorite Yogi-isms on social media.